instances in the last couple of months where we've actually had changes that have come out of the RACs. And so keep that in mind, and then we're going to go over a couple things real quick. First of all, I would like to turn around and have some new, we have some new members on the rec, and we're going to go ahead and go around the table here, and we'll start right over to my right with Danny. If we'd like to start there and introduce yourself, and then we'll work our other way around.
Pam Potts, I represent the non-consumptive, and I represent the non-consumptive interests, although I pretty much consume everything.
I'm Chris Schmitz, and I'm non-consumptive rep.
I'm Alan White, represent agriculture.
Ken Strong, sportsman.
Chris Marble, public at large.
My name's Ron Camp as well, but I'm sportsman.
Hey, Jay Maurer, I represent agriculture.
Mike Christensen, public at large.
George Garcia, Forest Service, federal.
Mike Gates, BLM.
Excellent. Thanks, guys and gals. Appreciate everybody taking the effort to come out tonight. July is always tough. Everybody's got vacations and other things going on. We'd like to excuse a couple because of that. And so with that in mind, let me go ahead and go over a couple of things, and then I'll go right into our approval from last of the agenda in minutes and things like that. But I also like to recognize, I was going to do a little bit later, but we actually have one of our wildlife newest board members here who have previously was on our central rack, and that's Carl Hurst. We welcome you here tonight. Exciting new adventure for you to be on the wildlife board. We claim you as our own. So, of course, if we ever have any problems, we're coming directly to you. All those in favor on that? Pretty well clear, it covers that one, but welcome. We always love to have the support of the Wildlife Board here at our RAC meetings. And so with that in mind, let me go over the procedure just a little bit. What we usually do here is we have an opportunity for the division to put forward their presentations on current things that are on the agenda tonight. As they do that, they will go through and explain and in great detail what their presentation is, and then we will open it up for questions. And questions would be, it either could be directly, but if you actually have a comment, you need to fill out one of these comment cards, and we'll come to that after the question period is over. And then if you'd like to comment, if you're an individual, you have 3 minutes to kind of get your point across. If you represent an organization, well, we can limit that to 5 minutes. And so the idea behind that is to try to make this as free as possible and as also move as quickly as possible so we can try to get everybody into that would like to make a comment or have a question. And with that, we probably need to do an approval of the agenda in the minutes. And so I need somebody to...
Well, I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve the agenda and minutes from the last meeting.
Second. And Ken Strong on a second on that. Thanks, Chris. And then what we're going to do at this point is I'm going to go into what happened at our last Wildlife Board meeting. Oh, we got a vote on that. I'm sorry. Thanks. That's why Chris is here. Thanks, Chris.
Welcome.
It's only, that's not, I made it like 5 minutes. That's not bad.
No, pretty good.
So anyway, let's go ahead and vote on that then. So I have a motion from Chris and a second by Ken to approve the agenda and the minutes. Could we have a vote on that, please, for approval of the minutes?
In favor.
All in favor? Okay. Any opposed? We have an unanimous except for Danny, who wasn't here last time.
One abstention.
Right, one abstention.
Right.
Okay. Now we're moving forward.
That's right.
Excellent. Wildlife Board was really quite quite unique. We actually had a couple of Wildlife Board members that stepped down after that meeting. We have John Bear, which had been the chairman for a number of years, stepped down, and also Dr. Mike King. Was was the last meeting for them. With that in mind, they actually called two new members of the Wildlife Board. Carl Hurst, which we've talked about already, was one, and Kevin Albrecht is the second Wildlife Board member that was called. My understanding from speaking with Carl tonight is that they have had approval from the Senate and now are waiting to be sworn in. So congratulations on that. Other items on the agenda from that, they actually had a couple things we talked about was the Utah Prairie Dog update. There's a current appeal, I believe, of the 10th Circuit Court on that. And there was an appeal that granted to put him back on the endangered species list on that. And the status kind of at this point is kind of unknown, as from what I understand on that particular situation on the prairie dog. The upland game and turkey hunt table recommendations that came from the RAC were approved by the board unanimously. The falconry rule amendments were passed with the removal of the 54 bird list and the addition of the five divisions bullet point, which is they added the division put on there, and that was passed 4-1. And much of that we talked about earlier as far as the what happens in the RAC, the falconry was very much a part of getting that taken care of through the RAC process. So there's an example right there where coming to the RAC and presenting your feelings does actually make a difference. And they do have a new board chairman on the Wildlife Board. The new board chairman is Dr. Woodward, and the vice chairman is Byron Bateman. And I believe that's pretty much what I have on that. So what I'd like to do on that then is move right over to our regional update with Jason, if you want to take over on that.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. And I welcome all the new RAC members as well. Thank you for being here and providing your time to this process. I really appreciate it. A couple of things for the RAC to share with them tonight, with the RAC members. Our wildlife section, they're starting to do, or currently are doing, some of their elk and pronghorn classification throughout the central region. I think this next week they'll be getting pretty heavy in the elk classification, and they've done some pronghorn already. If RAC members are interested in going out and classifying with any of our biologists, let me know, or Riley Peck, and we can get you on a ride along with the biologists, get you out in the field classifying either the pronghorn or the elk. The summer has been a little bit busy with nuisance bear calls. Some of you might have seen in the news the recent one in Park City where the bear actually got into a gentleman's house up there. So we've been busy grabbing the bear and taking them back and relocating them, and been successful doing that, and we hope that slows down. And most of these have been yearling bears that have been kicked off the sow and are trying to find their own way in the world. Aquatics, I think probably you'll remember in the past, Mill Creek has been chemically treated over the last several years to take out the browns and the rainbows and put in native Bonneville cutthroat trout. This last week, the lower portions that were treated last year were stocked again with 6-inch Bonneville cutthroat trout. So we continue in that process to get those back in that system. We have quite a few community ponds throughout the central region, and so we've been working on getting those stocked all summer long. Most recently, we've been transferring adult bluegill from Steinecker Reservoir out in the northeast region. We've been catching them there and bringing them to our community ponds. They're draining Steinecker, so we wanted to harvest those, salvage those. But we're starting to put quite a few warm water species, catfish and the bluegill and the like, into our community ponds. In our outreach section, we have a few things going on. On August 11th, we've got a fly fishing festival up in Heber City that our Scott Root, our outreach manager, will be participating in. So if you're up in that country around then, that'd be a fun activity to go hit. The next day, August 12th, there's an event up at Strawberry Reservoir. It's called Cast for Kids. And they can use help up there, and we will be, the Central Region staff will be up there helping some of the less fortunate kids up there, having some fun catching fish, hopefully. It's that time of the year. Hunts are about a month away, and we've got a lot of dedicated hunters in this region. So if you're a dedicated hunter, it's time to get your hours in if you haven't already done it. So we just encourage you to do that and share that message with everybody else. To don't wait till the last second to get that done. Our habitat section, they've been busy. They've got a couple projects going on here and there. Probably the biggest thing they're doing right now is installing upland game guzzlers, both out on the West Desert as well as on the Temp WMA. So they've been busy getting those in the ground. Some of those are in pretty remote areas, so we've been using a helicopter to transport those into those areas, and I think those efforts are going to pay off for our upland game. Our law enforcement section, probably two main things that they've worked on over the last month. On July 19th, they did a checkpoint up at Strawberry Reservoir, where they checked vehicles that were coming from the reservoir, people that had been fishing. They spent about 3 hours or 4 hours doing that. They contacted over 200 vehicles, checked for compliance on the fishing regulations. It was pretty busy. They had about 50 vehicles per hour, so they were hopping along there pretty well. They ended up having 36 violations on 34 reports and seized about 20 fish, some kokanee, but some violations on the regulations there at Strawberry. And then the other one of the other efforts for our law enforcement is our aquatic invasive species interdiction efforts, so it's AIS. Yesterday, I guess, they did an AIS saturation patrol on Utah Lake. So the primary concern is interdicting boaters coming from Lake Powell, which is positive for quagga mussels, and transporting them into Utah County or anywhere else throughout the state. So we spent a lot of time on Utah Lake. We spent time on Deer Creek. We spent time on Jordanelle, talking to a lot of people. They contacted about 250 folks, about 150 vehicles, boats, and trailers along that. Checked a lot of licenses. They ended up issuing several warnings and several citations as well. So one of the things we want to make sure is I think Deer Creek will hopefully be coming off of the quagga positive list here in the next couple of months if we can continue to show that they're not in there. But we want to make sure that we don't get quagga mussels in any of the other waters here in Utah. So we've spent a lot of time this summer trying to make that happen. That's all I really have to report, although Stacy did want me to remind you that the RAC and board member training will be held Wednesday, August 30th up at Shields in Sandy. It begins at 10 a.m. and runs till about 4 p.m. And she wanted to make sure that you knew that lunch will be provided, and they'll have a ton of fudge and nuts there.
Forever.
As well as some great information. So invite you all to attend that RAC and board training. Mr. Chair, that's all I have, unless there's any questions from the RAC. Danny?
Just one comment. I know it may not be that important, but also the division participated with the Wild Utah Project on the West Desert in Vernon Creek to do a rapid assessment training and also the potential to put in some analogs, some fake, if you will, man-made beaver dams. I think that's extremely valuable for the state of Utah. So.
Thanks, Danny. Yes, and we've started to do that throughout the state, as identify areas where we could put these beaver dam analogs, and it worked out really well out there. Our staff they had a lot of help from citizen scientists coming out and identifying areas for those to go, and so I think we're going to be successful on that area out there. So thanks, Danny. Any other questions, comments? Chris?
Yeah, I've got a question, Jason. So the checkpoint up there at Strawberry, the violations that occurred, was there anything consistent, or was it kind of all over the board?
It was all over the board. Some of it was the Coconies and playing out the Coconies, and but everything else, it was just violations of over-regulation fish. Primarily what that came in. They had some DUIs and things like that, but non-wildlife related things. But
gotcha.
Primarily they're looking for the wildlife violations.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate the update. Appreciate all the information and all the hard work that the division's doing, especially this summer. Helping to make the outdoors a little bit better for each and every one of us. First item up on the action item up is the Hunter Education Rule Amendments, and I guess Gary's here to go over that with us. So I'm going to go ahead and turn the time over to Gary Cook. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. Scott. I've got a presentation, I promise. Scott's just got me locked out here.
Right now, it's locked out.
Thanks, Kyle. Again, thank you. As mentioned, my name is Gary Cook. I'm the Hunter Education Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife. I've got a few proposed amendments to our Hunter Education Administrative Rule. So this past legislative session, House Bill 67 was passed through the session and in effect now. That's kind of generated this need to go through our administrative rule. The bill did a couple of things. Basically, it clarified the existing education requirement, some of that new language right here. It prohibits an individual from acquiring or possessing a hunting license or permit or a fur harvester license without successfully completing an approved education course, whether that be hunter ed or fur harvester ed. The bill's main focus was to allow the Wildlife Board the flexibility to be able to establish the criteria and standards of an approved education course, as well as establish the procedures for verifying that an individual has successfully completed one of those approved education courses. So basically, the problem that we have had historically, individuals were allowed to enter their hunter education numbers into our system. That led to some inaccurate records and also made it possible to defraud the system. Sometimes folks thought they knew their hunter education number, maybe put down a license number in that field rather than a hunter ed number, or didn't know it, so the system allowed them to enter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and there wasn't any automatic way to catch that. So the proposed amendments to the rule, again, the procedures for verifying that course completion. Right now, at the time of application for a license or permit, an individual they have three options. They either have to already have that valid hunter education number in the division's customer database, or they have to provide us with a certificate of completion, either from Utah or from another state that we recognize as an approved course. Or the third option is that they can certify by a sworn statement, self-certification. If they choose that option, then we have we can go back and we can research that individual's education records to verify completion of an approved course, whether that be our records, the database, hard copy records, or from another state. If we cannot verify that person has completed that approved course, they have to go through and complete an approved course in order to obtain a license or permit. Additionally, we've got some proposed amendments in there to modify the definition of terms in the rule to include those criteria and standards of what constitutes an approved education course. Just align some of those terms with our updated program procedures, and also address the addition of the Fur Harvester Education Program requirements in that administrative rule. The bill specifically talked about Fur Harvester Education. Previously, Fur Harvester Ed, there's a section in statute that addresses Fur Harvest for Education, and that's kind of what we relied upon, and then treated a lot of the administration of the program just like our hunter education program. There are a couple of minor differences, and those are now spelled out in that administrative rule. So these proposed amendments to the rule will help the division find that balance. We're trying to ensure hunter safety in the field while also providing good customer service to our hunters, which they need and expect. This new process in place will address those problems of being able to enter bad numbers, not being able to enter those bad numbers. It's important to note that with the proposed changes in the rule, the public will experience only very minor differences in how they obtain licenses or permits. This is really the process that we ask folks to go through right now to verify their hunter education requirements. And also important to note that this does not affect the trial hunting program. That new trial hunting program that we've seen about 3 years ago now, that remains an exception to this hunter education rule and still allows new hunters to be introduced to the sport under that supervision of a qualified mentor. That's really all I have on the presentation, unless there's some questions tonight.
I'll go to the rack first. Do we have any questions right now for Gary? I had one quick one, too, before I go to you, Danny. Is there a penalty that goes to the sworn affidavit on your own if you actually, I mean, do they get the permit right away? And then how long does it take the division to find out if they actually have that hunter education?
So typically, when if they do that self-certification process, that's happening in our big drawings, permit drawings. As soon as our licensing section has that information of who's self-certified, my program staff gets a list of those. We go through and we've made a lot of corrections and updates to our database, and then we'll send out a letter. It takes some time to go through that process. Any permit that is obtained, and that's part of the administrative changes there and amendments, proposed amendments. If it's obtained without being able to verify that, the license is an invalid license. So we do have recourses to be able to go after an individual that's obtained this license fraudulently.
Right. So because of the time of, I'm assuming by the time they enter into that policy and by the time they actually gets rewarded, you have 3 or 4 months or so to look into that.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand that. Danny?
No, that answered mine.
That was your question.
Was that your question? Yeah. What kind of? Anybody else on the rack who had a question pertaining to that?
Wrong.
Go ahead.
So just a quick question. So for the hunter safety, specifically for out-of-state folks, what is the anticipation there? You know, okay, I get the drawing process, but what is the anticipation there? You know, if they're going to get an over-the-counter tag, something like that. Do you have access to other state databases to be able to verify that quickly, or is that going to be a process where they're going to have to wait a little bit?
Again, as that list is generated with those individuals, be it resident or non-resident, the non-residents, there's a couple of different options. They can either provide that to us. They have some time there to be able to, if they've self-certified, then provide us with their out-of-state education completion.
Well, I guess I should ask, if somebody's from out-of-state, do they have to pretty much self-certify every time? Is that the process?
No, a lot of those individuals are in the database with a valid number.
Okay.
And that's
but only if
those
they,
first two options.
Is that only if they've hunted in Utah before, though?
Yes, they would have had to create that customer profile within our customer database, and typically to do that, then they've presented that proof of completion to a division representative to get that in there. So those, and that's, again, that's really where we're focused, is those first two options, either already be in the system or provide us with that certification. If you go with that self-certify option, then we've got a little bit of time there to be able to go through and try to verify that.
So that proof of certification, can that be provided to a license agent or only to a DWR employee?
It will have to be just to a, well, they can provide that same, if they have a blue card like we have in Utah from another state, they can provide that to a licensed vendor.
Okay.
If we have to research that their education records, then that would have to happen at one of our division offices, division employee.
Okay. So if you've never, so even if you've got proof, I'm just asking out of curiosity. So even if you have proof of hunter education certification from another state, but you've never hunted in Utah, you've got to go to a division office to get a tag. Is that what you're, or to get a permit or a tag?
No, not for a non-resident buying a non-resident license in Utah. Uh-huh. They can provide that proof of certification to a licensed vendor at Walmart, okay, Sportsman's, wherever licenses are sold, and they can issue that license.
So a little bit of a technical question, but if they go to enter it, because they use your portal, right, to out a tag, that sort of thing, they have to enter it into their portal. A license agent does, right? Their hunter certification number?
Right, their non-resident number would be entered into that in their customer profile.
But it would return no result because they'd never hunted in Utah before, right? But that's what I'm getting at. I'm trying to just figure out the process, make sure you thought of those types of things.
Yes, and if it puts them into that option, that, you know, that's their only option, is that self-certification, then it would have to go to a division employee to be able to verify and update that in the system.
Do we know how many people that might impact? Between,
I can tell you the first couple of years that we went through this with the big game draw, we saw lists of several thousand individuals that went through that self-certification process. It's getting better with each of those drawings that we go through, and as we update and fix these systems, the database. But we're still seeing, you know, it's pretty high numbers in when we've got 400,000 plus applications coming into a big game draw.
Okay.
Quite a bit of workload.
Thank you.
And I was going to say, follow up on that, I would just assume that once they present that valid from a different state to that, you don't have to go to DWR, obviously. The only thing that we're really dealing with is the ones who self-certify.
Right.
That need to go through the office, right?
Right.
Okay. Mike?
So what constitutes proof?
So to an approved course is a course either offered by us.
Okay, sorry. Like, we have a blue card,
right?
Our number is also listed on the license.
In Utah, it's actually not anymore.
Not anymore. Okay. So, but another state. So if a hunter from out of state came in and showed you their state's quote unquote blue card,
right,
that would be appropriate.
Correct.
Or if they showed you a license that had their hunter education number on it, what constitutes that proof? What do they have to show you?
The language in the rule states a document that has that proof of completion from another state, other states that may be a license, a hunting license, with that number on it. A lot of states are in the same boat as we are. They don't put that hunter education number on the license, so they would have to show us a completion card.
Okay.
And then if they're not able to produce that, that's where we get into following up with that state and trying to verify that they're in that state's database.
I'll ask you that. I mean, that's a good clarification.
Is there any states at all that we don't accept?
No, currently we have reciprocity with all 50 states, most Canadian provinces. The International Hunter Education Association, they set kind of the minimum standards for hunter education, and that's kind of that minimum bar that all the different programs, jurisdictions aim to meet. And that's basically what the rule says, is any course that meets those minimum qualifications or allows the completion of that course, or the completion of that course allows the individual to obtain a hunting license or permit in their home jurisdiction.
I've got a quick question for you. So let's say that I'm living in Kansas. I want to put in for the big game hunt. You don't have record of my hunting certificate, but I have proof that I did that. I'm assuming you're still going to have to be self-certified if I'm applying from Kansas. How do I know that? Unless
right there at the time of application, that would be your option is that self-certification. Then you're put into that loop where we have to verify it.
Have we thought about having the opportunity to be able to scan a document up and upload it right to your department at that point to prove that that was the case? So they could turn around and fill out the application and then just upload a document saying that's their hunter safety. And just kind of help you at the same time.
Yeah, we've thought about that. Not really an option with our system right now. We are looking at some I'm going through the process right now with trying to obtain a third-party vendor that is going to handle a lot of our administrative work with the Hunter Education Program and those databases. Once that's online, I'm hoping that some of those states that would have that, would have a document that they could do that with, that we could, look at that option. But currently, it's just not an option with the system that we've got.
So basically, if you're a first-time hunter in Utah, that may take a little while before your hunter safety is approved.
Verified. Yeah, there
after
is.
That, you're in the system, you're good to go.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions from the REC on this? Do I have any questions from the public concerning this? I don't see any. Do I have a motion on this? Though I don't think we have any comments on. I don't have any comment cards on this either. Do we have any comments from the? I don't have any from the public. So, REC, I'm ready for a motion.
Ron, I'll go ahead and make a motion to approve the Hunter Education Rule amendments as proposed.
Do I have a second? A second from AJ. So we have a motion on the Hunter Education Rule amendments. And let's go ahead and vote on that. All those in favor of the Hunter Safe Education Rule amendments as so presented tonight, go ahead and vote. Affirm. All right. I have a unanimous vote that everyone's in favor on that. Second was AJ right here. Thank you. Appreciate it. Next up, we have Darren. You've got quite a few today, don't you? Let's go ahead and get started on the first one, though. We have the Fur Bearer Rule Amendment. And how do we pronounce that last name?
Du Bois.
Excellent. Du Bois.
Yeah. Yeah, I apologize. I'm going to try and get you out of here at a decent hour, but I do have several things to go through here. Looks like it's working. So first on the agenda tonight, we would like you to consider some recommendations we have on the fur bearer and trapping rule. That's rule R657-11. First of all, let me give you a little bit of background on why we're asking to make a change. We did actually just do this rule last year. One of the changes in the rule last year was we changed the language so that the rule would only apply to protected wildlife species. That created a little bit of confusion and concern. The Trappers Association actually approached us and were concerned that since coyotes and raccoons were no longer included, that people didn't understand if they had to comply with our trapping rule. And if they didn't, they just didn't want to be in a gray area, and so they asked us to take a look at that. In addition, our law enforcement folks had some of the same concerns. The problem that they were starting to see is some people were out there claiming they were trapping coyotes, but they were all actually trying to catch protected wildlife, but they weren't, you could set on bait, you can do a lot of things, you didn't have to use the check times and things like that. And so we decided that we'd dig back into this rule and see if we could address those concerns. The first question that arises is, the Division of Wildlife Resources does not have authority over non-protected species, so specifically coyotes, and for the purposes of these changes, raccoons. And so it's difficult for us we had to ask the question, well, do we have authority then to regulate people that are trapping coyotes or raccoons out there in the field? There's some fairly recent data that's come out of the Association for Fish and Wildlife Agencies, which is sort of the national wildlife management group. It covers the entire United States. They're the ones that come out with best management practices for trapping, for example, that we use heavily in our rule. And they found that there is a significant risk when you set a trap out there that you might catch a protected species. So traps are, you know, if you're setting for coyotes, there's a chance, enough of a chance, that you might catch something you didn't intend. That we felt like the division then has the authority to protect wildlife that is protected, and therefore we can, we feel like we're within our realm of responsibility here to look at trapping specifically in the state. So this is what we're proposing. I know you have a red line copy, but this is sort of it in a nutshell. The first thing is that any trapping that takes place outside of 100 feet of a home or outbuilding occupied by humans or livestock must comply with the trapping rules established by the Utah Wildlife Board. And specifically in the rule, it includes coyotes and raccoons. The reason that we did this is we didn't want to try to regulate trapping that might be going on around a house, and that includes trapping mice, you know, things like that. So we put that buffer around these properties so people could take care of problems in and around their buildings. But if they're outside of that 100 feet, then they need to comply with our trapping rules. The second change is currently, in order to trap protected wildlife in the state, you have to have a trap registration number that has to be on your traps when they're set in the field. What we're going to do is we're going to call that number a trap registration license. For people who currently have a number, we'll just transfer that number into the license. They'll get the license free of charge. It should be relatively painless, and people that are currently in the system won't have to do anything there. But people that are beginning to trap in the state would buy this registration license. When they buy the license, they immediately are given a trap registration number that's associated with the license, and that's what they put on their traps. And thirdly, I guess I just covered that. So, and that'd be a $10 fee, which is currently it is $10 to get your trap registration license. So it's a little bit of a change, but not a huge change there. A person must carry the trap registration license on their person while in the field. That includes our app, so if you've got it on your phone, that counts. But just like any other license, you need to have it there so you, if someone checks you, you can show them that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And finally, what this does is it gives some protection to people who accidentally catch something that they're not intending to catch, provided that they do certain things. First of all, that they're not attempting to take an unauthorized species. Second, that they have their registration license. Third, they have all the necessary permits and tags required to trap the species they are attempting to take. And then finally, complying with our trapping rule and codes. That includes the 48-hour trap check on live traps, all of the other things. None of that will change as part of these changes. If they do all of those things and they accidentally catch something they didn't intend to, it protects them from criminal prosecution. We're not going to go after somebody that's out there in the field honestly pursuing their trapping and accidentally catches something they didn't intend to. So that's it.
Thanks, Darren. I'll open it up to the RAC if we have any questions for Darren on this particular amendment. Mike?
So where did the 100 feet come from?
You know what? That was our best stab. That's open to negotiation. The intent is just what I said. It's we don't want to regulate people trapping mice. We don't want to regulate people trying to take care of raccoons around their houses and barns and things like that. But other than that, you know, 100 is what we came up with. So if you want to discuss that, then certainly we're open to that.
Okay. And so does that also include like live catch traps, like a have a heart trap?
Yeah, it include any kind of trapping, yeah.
Okay. And so to obtain the trapping license that you carry in the field, you also have to go through the trapping course or the fur bearers course, education course?
You know, my understanding is that's not mandatory. I know we've got trappers here. Does that ring true with you guys? For harvester education? It is? Okay, that's right. It's like hunter ed, so yeah, they would. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry.
Okay. Are there any provisions within the rule that deal with depredation?
Yeah, there are. So for things like beavers and all the stuff that was there before about, you know, you can handle things that are depredating through the rule. Now, if you're a private landowner and you're trapping coyotes specifically, this would affect you. You wouldn't need to have your traps registered if you're not within that curtain, that boundary.
Yeah, so if you're more than 100 feet away from the building, you'd have to have that.
Right.
And so, and then, like, for example, I've got questions on this because there seems like a lot of gray areas to me. What constitutes a building that used for livestock? Like, for example, yeah. we have on our ranch, we have a large hay barn.
Right.
It's not used for livestock. It's used to store hay. But it also attracts,
right.
You know, nuisance animals that cause problems.
Yeah, I think, again, the intent is that you'd be able to handle things in your barns. It's similar language to what we have with the shooting rule of 600 feet from a occupied or, you know, someplace where human habitation is going on. So again, the intent would be that you'd be able to do that without worrying about complying with the trapping regulation.
And I understand the intent. I worry about the nets mm-hmm. being made pretty wide to
right.
catch up, you know, people that.
Right.
So, I think that's all I have for now for okay. questions.
Do I have any other questions here on the rec?
Maybe I missed it. What's the reason for 100 feet? Because I know on some of our outbuildings and things and neighbors, 100 feet's not very far to be trying to catch nuisance
right.
when they're coming from a source where you know they are.
Yeah, again, it's an attempt to try to preclude that kind of activity from having to comply. But you got to draw a line somewhere. So I think the distance isn't quite as important as long as we get the, you know, I don't think we'd want 2 miles or something like that, but, you know.
Any other questions? Any questions from the public? If anybody has any yellow cards that they want to turn in, best to turn them in, just send them up here so I can call you up on that. Okay. I don't have any comments on this particular one, I don't believe, on this particular amendment. Any comments from the RAC itself?
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, one real quick. So, Mike, AJ, you guys that have experience with this, is there a better number than 100 feet?
Well, a square acre's 208 feet. So, I mean, my personal opinion is that I can see what they're trying to do. I just think that really quick, anything that's redlined was in the rule before and stricken from the rule.
Right.
And anything that's red is added to the rule.
Right.
And so this rule had a lot of red added to it, and we saw very little of that up there. And so I think it has to be, I would use the words well over 100 feet. You know, 100 feet, that's 33 yards. You know, that's, throw a football a lot farther than that. And for me, like, I look at it like just coming from my situation, I want the trap away from my animals and my house and my kids and my dogs and my cats. And right. So...
And remember, it's a one-time $10 fee.
But you have to go through the course and be educated on that. Right. And I look at it also, like from a have a heart live catch trap, we're putting that in the net with a leg hold trap as far as regulations go, and I don't think that those two things coincide. And I personally cannot support this the way it's written. For the distance, for the regulation of, you know, somebody that's trying to not injure or harvest that fur bearer, we've had a lot of problems with foxes. Mm-hmm. They'll come into your, when your cows are calving out in the field, and they'll eat the calf while it's being birthed. Mm-hmm. And I want to put a trap out there to catch that fox, but I don't want to, and I don't know, it's hard to have,
right.
That's why there should be a depredation type of an issue there, and I didn't see it written into the rule when I read through it.
Yeah, I mean, there's other rules that address depredation situations, and this one specifically talks about, you know, beavers and things like that, but we have a kind of a separate track to deal with, you know, through the local biologist and deal with depredation issues as they arise. But again, to put a trap out under the way the rules proposed, if it's outside 100, you'd have to get trapper education, you'd have to have a trap number, all those things. So that's what we're saying.
Yeah, exactly, and that's why, for me personally,
which you would have to do if it's a protected species anyway. It's just now for coyotes and raccoons specifically.
Do you have a proposed amendment that would get you there, or do you feel like the rule's just too far off?
I personally feel like the rule catches too many. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't want to try to write the rule. I see the intent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want some kind of miscatch out there and or a trap that's not being checked in time. I would personally, to me, the cage trap should be, there should be another section written on just a cage trap.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can go buy a cage trap at Walmart and put it out behind your house.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and
which would be
100,
fine.
110 feet away, you know. I mean, we have, I don't know.
Right.
You would be breaking the law.
What we don't want to do is put our enforcement folks into a position where they've got to make a decision. We need to have something that's enforceable, and so that's why, you know, we drew it at 100 feet. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's a magic number that can't be violated.
I don't think you're ever going to get to a magic number.
Right.
Yeah.
You're going to debate the distance thing forever.
Mm-hmm. That's, I agree with that too.
Well, I suggest that even though we're not going to get to a magic number, but if we use the 600 feet like we use in the shooting thing, it would make it a little easier and more understandable, because it at least corresponds with that.
Yeah.
I got one.
When you're talking 600 feet, 100 feet, whatever it is, you brought up, you know, and say you got cattle out on the range. You know, maybe from the problem, you know, not a building, but maybe your livestock. You know, something like that needs to be clarified, because how many people have problems out away from the buildings and area occupied? So, yeah.
So I've got a question on that, guys. So I'm hearing the heartache over that, but and I just got to ask, what's the big deal if you're a rancher going getting certified, taking the course, and then that's it? Whenever you need to use it, you can deploy them.
You don't need to be certified if it's December 31st.
Sure, but anybody that fall under this rule, yeah. Sure. Even those that do, I'm sincerely asking, what's the big deal?
Well, I think we're forcing people, and I'm looking at it. I'm not looking at it from a harvesting for fur at all. I'm looking at it from like the public's. Trappers they're a rare breed, and I've been to trapping rendezvous. I know there's not a lot of people that do that. But when we looked at the public at large, I have a little bit of heartburn, foreseeing, because in 10 years, where this could be the law, I have a hard time forcing somebody to go take that course that they bought to have a heart trap down at Walmart to take care of some raccoons or something that within 100 feet of their house or 600 feet, I don't know.
Right, and I think, again, within, for that purpose and within that boundary, I think we can figure out, how we want to do that, whether it's 600 feet or 100 feet or whatever. The thing for us, though, is if our officers run across a trap in the field and it's not marked, they have no idea who set it there, why it's there. I mean, they have ways to investigate that. But this rule tries to address that. Yeah. It'll have a number on it. They can figure out who it is, and if it's a landowner trying to catch coyotes, they can figure that out. So,
my understanding on the rule, from a layman's point of view, since I don't trap, would be the fact you just want clarification, so that if I'm wanting to put a trap out and I know I want to put it over 100 feet, I got to take the course.
Yeah. Right.
And if I don't take the course, I'm in violation.
Right.
And if I want to put one out at 99 feet, I'm good.
Right.
And so I guess the point, I understand exactly where your guys are coming from, but I guess I'm going to read in between the lines a little bit here. I'm not sure that they're really after you. There might be after people who are out trapping illegally and now have some clarifications that enforce that a little bit more. Is what my guess is we're looking at on this law is a little bit of aid to help our law enforcement enforce the current laws we have, because typically the people who are in the trapping industry that do it all the time are law abiding.
Right, exactly.
We're trying to maybe not blur the lines and make them a little bit more.
Right, that was both our law enforcement folks' concern and the Trappers Association's concern, is that it kind of, we want clarification. And again, if there's someone out there that's a bad actor, it really helps our officers to make a case if they're not following the trapping rules.
That's the real question. How do you enforce that? Pardon me, but if you're trying to catch a guy that's catching bobcats after the season, your statement said, that's who you're targeting. Well, how can you tell? And giving him, he's already registered and taken the course to be out there during the late season. I see it all the time later on. I mean, that's my question, is how are you going to gain that vice to say, okay, got you.
Yeah.
Season. Okay, say, I'm just going to grab a kite.
Right. I don't know if anyone from law enforcement wants to talk to that, but I'm not a law enforcement officer. I mean, there are a myriad of ways to make cases. But one thing that you can make a case and have it thrown out if there aren't clear guidelines about what's right and what's wrong, and you've got to prove that the person knew.
And that's kind of my understanding of this, is trying to maybe make a little bit more clear guidelines. So in these situations where people do take advantage of that there might be a better way of being able to enforce that now. And with nothing, where we are right now, it's pretty loose. And so it makes it really difficult. And so...
Was there any thought put towards live traps, like what Mike's talking about, have a hard type trap?
We talked about different trapping devices, and we just came down on including everything. But yeah, there's no reason we couldn't take a look at that.
All right, any more questions from the RAC on this matter?
Take a motion.
I'm willing to take a motion. Anybody want to do a motion on this action on the Ferber Rule Amendment?
Well, I would make a motion that we accept it, but we change the 100 to 600.
Okay, we have a motion to change the rule from 100 feet from a primary residence or a building to 600 feet. Is there a second on that?
I would second that if we could also better define what a building is.
That's
one of my hang-ups, too. Is
it a shed?
I'm thinking probably from a clarification standpoint. I think I think what they're really dealing with is the fact is that even though it's said that they're not the target, it puts them in an interesting position if they actually go out and trap outside that 100 feet, and then potentially they become the target. Would I be right on that?
Right. Yeah. You're creating somebody that's trying to do law abiding thing, and you're sweeping them up in a big net.
Here's the actual language. This may help or it may not help, but I'm not a lawyer, but a lawyer did write it. So the trapping risk. So do not apply to a trapping device, and a trapping device is defined as any apparatus used to remotely capture or kill an animal, including a cage trap, foothold trap, snare wire, any other body gripping mechanism. So it does not apply if you're within 100 feet of a building or structure occupied or utilized by humans or livestock, provided the trapping device is set to capture a coyote or raccoon and with the landowner or leasee's permission.
Key word there is utilized.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Used for something, storage, whatever.
Yeah.
That sagebrush might be used for feeding your livestock. You know what I'm saying?
Barns. I think all those fall under that.
Yeah. The hunting blind.
Right.
If I could, too, guys, if we have a comment, it's best to come up and state your name and go in the mic so it can go on the record. Otherwise, it won't be picked up and won't get in the system. I think it is helpful because I think the word utilized for any purpose really does broaden that range quite a bit for you.
The intent was to exclude all barns, things, people just doing stuff around their properties. But once you get out kind of in the field, that's when we want to make sure people are complying.
Do you have any specific anxiety or reaction to 600 feet as opposed to 100?
Like I said, I don't think 100 is a magic number. That I think is fine. It just you know, widens that buffer, and so.
Oh, I'll second the motion.
Okay, we have a second on this motion. It is on the Ferber Rule Amendment to accept everything in the amendment except with the change of a 100 foot designation to a 600 foot designation. Is that correct?
Yes.
So we have a motion on the floor and a second. Can we vote on that at this point then? All those in favor of that, go ahead and vote. Okay, I have 8-4 and all those against and one against. Thank you. Let's go ahead and move on to the next one, which is the Ferber and Bobcat Harvest recommendations. Thanks, Darren.
From the rule to the recommendations for next season, Ferber and Bobcat season. First of all, I just wanted to quickly remind everybody what we do, how we manage bobcats in the state, and what criteria we look at. So there are three things that we look at. The first is the numbers of juveniles in the harvest. We try to target between 42 and 56%. That's sort of our range. If it's higher than 56%, that's okay, but it probably means there's some opportunity that's being missed there. If it's lower than 42%, we feel like that's too high of a harvest on juveniles, and we want to make adjustments to correct that. Okay. So having said that, here is a graph which shows the percent of juveniles in the harvest since the year 2000. The red dotted line is the 42% threshold below which we don't want to fall. And you can see over the last 4 years we've been above that. So we're within our management parameters on juvenile percent in harvest. The second criteria that we look at is adult survival. We want it to be between 65 and 72%. Again, if it's higher than 72%, that's okay. If it's below 65, we want to take a look at things. Adult survival is an indication of whether the population is growing or not. And 65% is kind of that lower threshold where if you get below that, you probably have a population that's declining. And so here is a graph showing our adult survival since 2000. That last point is actually it's an artifact of Excel. It's a little bit. It's actually not below. It is 65%. So it's right on the bubble, but it is within management parameters this year. We have seen a little bit of a decline over the last few years. Right now, it wouldn't affect our recommendations, but it is something that we want to keep an eye on. The third management criteria is the percent of females in the harvest. We want that to be between 41 and 45%. In this case, we don't want it to be lower. We don't want it to be above 41%. You know, the more females you have in the harvest, again, you're probably causing a population to decline. So if it's higher than 41%, we need to look at making some changes. And here's the graph. This year, and once again, you can see 40 and 42, it's an artifact, and I couldn't figure out how to fix it, but it is right at 41% for females in the harvest. So based on those criteria and our management plan, we were recommending, so here's kind of performance targets over the last 3 years and the management range that we're looking at. For percent adult survival and percent female, we're right at the lower end of that bracket, but according to our plan, if we're within the bracket, we won't make any changes to the harvest strategy. A couple of other things to look at. This is a graph that shows how many permits we sell since about 2005 compared to the number of permit buyers. There's a lot of concern in 2014 when we went to this new management strategy where we allowed unlimited tags, but each person could have up to six. You can see that the very next year, sales and permit buyers shot way up. Everybody kind of reacted to that change. But over the last couple of years, people have kind of come down on a pretty steep slope. We feel like that'll probably normalize, and we'll see something similar to what we saw before the change. So we're keeping an eye on it, but it looks like people are kind of finding an equilibrium after the change. Another thing that's interesting to note is that probably more than anything, the price of pelts for bobcats really is what drives the number of people who are out trying to trap bobcats, which is probably fairly intuitive. If the orange line is the price of pelts, the blue line are the number of people in the field, and you can see it kind of tracks a year. So price goes up, everybody buys a permit the next year. Price goes down, everybody kind of drops off the radar. And again, they kind of cycle together like that. It also shows you where current prices are. They're kind of maybe mid to low, average to low on bobcats. So the recommendations are essentially no changes from last year. Again, still six tags per individual. An individual can purchase up to six tags for bobcat. There is no cap on permits statewide. The season will be November 15th, 2017 through March 1st. And then just some other season dates for other fur-bearing species. So beaver and mink is different than other things, September 23rd through April 4th of 2018. And then everything else ends on March 1st in 2018. That's it.
Thank you, Darren.
Yep.
Do you have any questions from the rec?
I do. I got one question, Ron. So the question that I had was, so you talked about the metrics, and, you know, we don't want to, you know, if we go to a certain end of the metrics, we want to make an adjustment. Now, I understand that we're within the metrics, but just barely, and we're trending down pretty hard.
On a couple of them, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, educate me on bobcats. If we were to see that with big game, we'd be a bit concerned and starting to react now,
right?
Rather than waiting for them to fall below the targets.
Yeah, that buffer, that zone is kind of the safety zone. So, you know, if you start seeing it dip below that, you need to start making adjustments. So what the plan says is if two of those metrics are outside in a negative direction, then we'll do a couple things.
Sure.
One is shorten season. So, again, if it continues on the trend, next year you'd see a recommendation for shortened seasons and capping permits is another.
Do you see that trend continuing?
It's hard to say. You know, you can see it kind of cycles and bounces around. It probably has more to do with prey availability than almost anything else. As you mentioned, you know, the numbers of bobcats available in the state, the number of people taking bobcats, you know, is probably not enough to make any huge, at least the take by people is probably not the biggest driver in the system. So again, you know, we want to keep an eye on things and make adjustments, but I don't think we need to panic if we see a downward trend, as long as it's within the buffers, and then we'll adjust if we need to.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments? Questions, actually. Sorry. You didn't correct me, though. You were good. Any questions from the public? I do have some comment cards we'll get to in just a minute. But any questions on this from the public? Okay, let's move right into comments then. Ron, did you want to talk on this as well as the beavers? Is that what I'm assuming?
Yeah.
Is he supposed to fill out a separate one when a beaver comes up too, or can I just put it at the back of the list at the end? Yeah, okay. I'll turn it around. Go ahead. Go ahead and go up to the mic. Go ahead and state your name.
Ron Holt. I'm the secretary for the Trappers Association. We would like to see the price of the bobcat tags go back down to $5. It's $15 as it is now, and the money doesn't fund anything other than the print of the tags, I think. Other states around us, Wyoming, they don't have a tag system like that for the fur harvesters. They just catch as many as they want, and that's what we would like to see. And another week put on the back end of the trapping season. That's when the big males are out roaming, looking for females, and that's when you have the best opportunity on them.
Okay.
Thank you.
You bet. Dan, is it Coskany? Cocaine. Do you have a comment on the bobcat?
Yeah, Dan Cocaine, I'm president of the Utah Houndsman Association. I actually checked no, so you could just read that. But we would support both those things that the trappers are suggesting. That week on the end does, I think, helps that trend towards the older adults, and also the price.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you for clarification,
Jason. Hey, we're new. with that in mind, I have a couple questions, though, a couple comments. I'm assuming the reason we raised the price up from $5 to $10, $15 to get a little more revenue. to help with the management of the
I don't know
or do we know
the whole
that?
History behind that price increase, but I think in general, you know, we saw a deficit there that, you know, the cost to manage compared to the cost of the tag. I did actually ask about, you know, that, and the general feeling on the director's office was, you know, we just asked the legislature to increase that tag. I don't think that there's a lot of desire to go back. But again, this is a public process, so.
Yeah, that's one thing, that those fees are set by the legislature.
Right.
And there's a few things that we can't accomplish here, and that's one of them. It really has to be a change with the legislature.
One thing I can do is maybe get a little more history on this and get with the trappers and kind of explain what our thinking was when we raised the tags, and you know, that might help, it might not, but we can keep talking about it.
My experience has been, once they have the taste of that extra money, it's hard to get it back.
Yes. It is the government. We're here to help.
Let's go ahead and go on the other comment, though, about the lengthening of the season. I don't trap, so I have no, I'm pretty much have no knowledge of that.
Right. I think they're right biologically, and, you know, they're probably, you know, we're going to manage the plan, so if those, you know, if it causes those targets to drop, we'll cut the season back again. So, you know, that's something you guys could discuss if you want.
Isn't lengthening the season something we've talked about in the last two racks on cats? And we've lengthened them on those. So this is this adding another length on, or is this just going back to the original?
And I think probably the reason that the season was set where it is now is, you know, we went through this bobcat plan again, and we really opened the availability of permits up, and we weren't sure what was going to happen. I think when that graph I showed how, you know, we got that big spike in purchasers, and then it's coming back down. You know, maybe that's not as big of it. We just didn't know what would happen, so I think we were being conservative. We kind of shortened things up to make sure we didn't, you know, the wheels didn't come off the very next year, but it looks like things are doing okay. So.
I was just going to say, is there still a concern of over-harvest if there is another week added on to that?
I don't think so. And again, if it's mainly male harvest, that's not, I mean, from a population standpoint, that's not as concerning as that. You know, we'll look at it, and again, if it's outside of our parameters, we'll be back next year to recommend a change one way or the other. Regardless, you know, if you were to add an extra week in the rack, then yeah.
Is that something that if we actually put forth here tonight would affect this year, or that'd be a 2018 deal either way?
You're voting on it now, so yeah.
So we could make it effective this year?
Yeah, assuming it, you know,
okay.
The board approved.
I just wanted a clarification on it, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page.
The only thing, just again, I'm not 100% sure. One thing I will need to check is if that's set in the plan, it may be difficult to change it because the board approved the plan. I'm not sure where it is, but we may need to double check, and I don't have the plan in front of me at the moment. But I'd say go ahead and do what you guys
want. My biggest concern only is because I'm ignorant on it, and I hate to vote for something I don't know anything about, and to put my name on something and I don't know the impact of that one way or the other. If I was more educated on the value and how it helped you, I would be more willing personally to jump on that. I don't know whether it's the right move or the wrong move, and so in that, it's hard for me to make a move. And so that's just me personally, but open up for any other comments on the rack on that.
Is the start date, is that like a set date in the rule or in your plan?
It changes year to year.
Does it? Kind of like
it's like the first. It probably calls it out as a first Saturday. I wish I had the rule like right in front of me, but again, if it's in the rule hard and stone, we'd have to, or not the rule, in the plan, we'd have to make changes to the plan to allow that to happen. I have it here, but I don't know how quick I can be to find it. But
if it varies, that's fine. I just didn't know if it was a hard, fast date.
It does, yeah. It'll adjust year to year.
Ron, the good news, I don't have a vote.
Right, yeah. Ron, you just voted from going from 100 feet to 600 feet with any data or information. So why is this any different?
I didn't get a vote on that either. I just sit there and bring it up. So with that in mind, I guess we're looking for a motion of some type, I would assume. Do we have any more comments?
Just to clarify, so they're asking for a week addition to the end of the season, not an adjustment.
Right.
To get the same weeks.
Okay.
Yeah, they want to add a week.
Okay.
So, Ron.
No, go ahead.
Are you going to make a proposal?
Well, I was going to, but I wanted one more clarification.
Okay. All right.
So, is that okay if I...
You betcha.
All right. So I had one question, Darren. I wondered if you could just bring up one slide for me.
Sure.
With the metrics, our targets.
Uh-huh.
Oh, hold on. Shut down on me here. Yeah, it's all right. There aren't that many slides. Which one? So not, well, keep going. So there was a, keep going. Right there.
Okay.
So if we look at our percent juvenile for 2017, we're actually over the target, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. If we look at percent adult survival, we're right at the bottom end of it. And if we look at our percent female, I think Ken's like theirs.
Right.
Go over part of it. But percent female harvest, we're right at the bottom of that.
Right.
So my concern with extending the season another week is you're right at the bottom of every single metric.
What you could,
in fact, you're over on,
right, you
which
could,
is under.
It could affect adult survival, and that's derived from the ages of animals in the harvest. Again, mm-hmm. You know, we can do that, but if, you know, if we look at the numbers next year and we fall below those, the plan will have us adjust things.
Sure. Like I said, I'm not super familiar with bobcat biology. I know with big game we'd be panicking
right
now.
Yeah.
So based on that, I'd like to make a motion that we approve the recommendations as presented.
I would like to amend that. And being that the extra week added on would mostly affect the males, which wouldn't really affect the reproduction, I'd like to propose this.
Well, my only concern with that, Ken, is just the percent of adult survival.
I realize that, but we're talking about males instead of, and we
right,
can lose a bunch of those and we're still okay.
Right. No, that's understandable. I just, you know, that's the management plan targets, and that's my concern.
So I would like to amend that
I'll withdraw my proposal and
let me just add one thing. I'm sorry, I do have the plan. The way the plan reads is that the season is the third Wednesday in November to March 1st. So that end date right now is hard in the plan. So we would have to amend the plan, but that doesn't mean you guys can't vote to do that, and then we'll just have to figure out how to make it happen. Does that make sense?
Okay, I have, just for clarification, I have Chris that has now stepped out.
I'll withdraw.
Has withdrawn from that, and do I have another motion on the table? Go ahead, Ken.
I'll make a motion that we accept the division's proposal, with the exception that we add a week onto the trapping season.
Can we just, would it be okay, Ken, if we just entertain the amendment separately and then approve the rest of the plan after?
That's fine.
Okay.
Does your plan, you said the trapping season, are we talking about bobcats?
Bobcats. For bobcats. Add a week onto the bobcats.
Because
right now in the plan, the end date is March 1st, so what we would have to do is amend the plan to allow an extra week, and the board can do that.
I need a second on that before we can actually vote on that.
Make that change, or before that change, but a couple of years ago when we first extended away from the bobcats,
it'd be a lot easier if you came up with the mic. Sorry. It's hard to hear you. We're old. Too many rifles.
I wasn't going to comment, but
Go ahead and state your name, too.
Jerry Carlson.
Thank you.
We made this change. We extended the week a couple seasons ago. And in the process of that, they did not extend the other fur bearer animals along with that week, which caused a problem. They fixed that last year. So if we extend that, we need to also extend the the normal fur bearers that additional week along with the, does that make sense?
That's my concern.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks, that's a good point.
As a matter of discussion, can you tell us if extending it a week has a biological effect on the fur bearers that it... Like, will they catch more toms?
It's hard to say until it happens. I think the thinking is sound, mm-hmm. and that tends to be when they're out and moving and more vulnerable to harvest. Again, you know, males, sad to say, guys, aren't that important when it comes to population biology. So everybody should know that. But again, you know, we've got those targets and triggers, so we can adjust. Again, if it was big game, I know we'd be in a panic. These things are crashing, but this is a relatively abundant resource with a relatively small number of people harvesting it. Fluctuations probably have more to do with the number of prey species than anything else. So we can adjust. It's not going to be the end of the world.
Yeah. Along the lines of what he just stated, will it affect other species?
Again,
same thing.
Same thing, yeah. I think we're fine.
Well, I know we've extended it the last 2 years, and last year we did extend it for, I believe even 2 years ago we extended it on all the trapping for 1 week. I think it was proposed 2 weeks.
But I'm not sure the board accepted that.
Ken Fowden, we did, 3 years ago, we proposed a time extension on bobcat season with the caveat that if we could prove that we would harvest more toms, they would give us the time, which we did. Biologically, it's been proven. Your predecessor had a graph with the data on it, and the last 2 weeks of the season, you will historically harvest more toms, and it will show up in your adult survivability and your females, and your kitten survivability goes up too. So historically, trappers do not harvest more than around 2,400 cats annually. The 30-year average is like 1.67 cats per trapper, over a 30-year harvest. You cannot, honestly, you cannot harm these cats. Biologically, their own prey base will harm them by far more than human harvest.
But just a question for you, but the catch in those last 2 weeks isn't all toms. There are still juveniles and females in the catch, right? I mean, I understand it's largely toms.
But the greater majority,
sure.
A significant increase right. In adult toms.
Sure. I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Danny.
Yeah, you gotta have my two cents worth. You know, and I don't question any of the discussion. I think it's all great. The biological rationale, I'm all behind all of that. However, because it's not in the management plan, I'm not going to support anything that isn't incorporated into the management plan. So it just seems like to me that what we ought to do is attack the management plan and get that changed first before we ever go, you know, willy-nilly down the it's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
How long ago was the management plan amended?
I think 2 years ago.
Still not that long ago.
Not that long ago. And again, it is worth pointing out that these plans have a lot of people on the committees that consider all of these things. And you know, it's probably something we should take, you know, seriously when we make decisions. But yeah.
When does the plan expire?
It calls for review, I think, every 10 years or as needed, but it doesn't have an expiration date, so it can be addressed. You know, if there's changes that need to be made, it can be opened up.
I know the last 2 years that we have extended, 2 years ago for the bobcat, but last year we extended for everything, and that division asked us to extend it for everything, right, to make it easier for them.
Yeah, then there's not a question about what you're out there setting traps for.
And we're just doing the same thing as last year, right now.
Yeah,
it's the same. What is proposed is the same as last year.
Is that correct, Kent?
Well,
that was being proposed now was the same as last year?
Yes.
The dates?
Yes.
Okay, moving along on this, we do have a motion from Ken to accept this with the caveat of extending the hunt, I'm assuming, on it to all.
To all.
On the fur bearers.
Uh-huh, for one week.
So that would be March 8th, if I do my math right in my head. All right, guys?
Should be, yeah.
Okay. I still don't have a second on that, so.
I'll second it.
And then I have a second, so let's go ahead and put that to a vote. So with this is the fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendations as presented tonight, with the exception of the actual hunt extending 1 week from the current close date of March 1st, and that would also include all fur bearer permits going out 1 week for enforcement point of view. Is that correct?
Yes.
Let's go ahead and vote. All those who would agree with that, go ahead and vote. And those against? I have 6-4 and 3 against. Darren, moving on.
All right. Next, we'll talk about our cougar recommendations.
6-4 and 3 against. Oh, sorry. Chris, Danny, Christina.
So again, just a quick background for everybody on how we manage and hunt cougars. We hunt under several different season types. The first is a limited entry unit, where you have to draw a tag, and those are all the tags that are available for that unit. The second hunt strategy is a split unit. It begins as a limited entry unit for a specific amount of time. Once that time expires, then it opens up to anybody who has a harvest objective permit on that unit, provided there are any unharvested animals. It's a permit quota combination. The third is a harvest objective unit. This is a unit that just has a quota for harvest. Anybody that buys a tag can hunt any of those harvest objective units, provided they have those permits. And those seasons generally are year-round. And then finally, we have a pursuit season, which is an opportunity for people to go and use their dogs to tree cats. They're not trying to harvest an animal. They're just, you know, training dogs or, you know, trying to, you know, get out there and see the animals, that kind of thing. So similar to bobcats, we have management targets for lions. In this case, we have two. Probably the most critical is, again, the percent females in the harvest. We want that to be less than 40%. And the second is the percent of adults in the harvest. We want that to be between 15 and 20%. If it's higher than that, it's okay, but that means that we've probably got opportunity to increase permits. If it's lower than that, we need to look at decreasing quotas or permits in order to get that number back up. The only exception to that is that if we have units where prey populations are under objective and we have concerns that mountain lions could be affecting those prey population numbers, for example, mule deer or bighorn sheep, we can make adjustments outside or recommendations outside of these targets. We just need to write a management plan and explain what we're doing and how long we'll do it and when we'll make adjustments and so forth. So that's how we manage. This graph shows historic lion harvest since about 1990, so this is a lot of years of data. If you look at it, the green line is the total number, males and females, and this is everything. The sort of pink line is females, and the blue line is males, for no particular reason. One thing to point out is that in the mid-90s, we were harvesting large numbers of lions across the state. The first management plan, the most recent version, came in 1999, and you can see that after that date, some adjustments were made. And harvest came down a little bit. Over the last 10 years, it's been increasing. One thing worth pointing out is that the females in the harvest has remained relatively stable over the last several years, where so most of the increase in harvest has been in the male population. And we already had discussions about males and populations. This graphic kind of shows the proportion of males and females in the harvest. You can see since about 2008, we've been on the male side. The dashed line is our 40% objective for females in the harvest. We want to be below that line for females. The second target is the percent of adults in the harvest. So since 1999, this is a graph that shows the percent of animals older than 5 years in the harvest. And you can see that's been also increasing. It jumps around, but if you drew a trend through that, hopefully you can see that over the last 10 years that's also increased a little bit. We've been increasing mule deer numbers significantly over that same period of time, and it's probably not a coincidence that we're seeing an increase in lion numbers as well. Another thing that's worth noting is the average age in the harvest. This is the average age of males since about 2000. That's an increasing trend. That, you know, if you look at the last graph, it's everything kind of sort of pooled, but this is average age of everything that's harvested, so it's a little bit different. And then this is the females in the harvest. Again, maybe an increasing trend. I think that might be pushing it a little bit, but at least it's stable, probably. Excel will draw a trend line on anything, but I don't want to abuse that. One other thing that we consider is livestock depredation, and here's our graph showing what that's been doing since about 2001. We had a pretty good dip, a bit of a bump in about 2012, again a decrease, and then over the last few years that's increasing. That's a concern for us. So the green line are the number of reported incidences. This is where Wildlife Services goes out and investigates livestock depredation by cougars, and the red or orange line are the number of cougars that Wildlife Services then takes as a result of those complaints. And again, both over the last 3 years have been trending up. That probably has a lot to do with population numbers just in general. But again, that's something that we're looking at, and that plays into our recommendations this year. So now moving on to specific permit recommendations. This is for the northern region. I'll just point out the changes, and of course, if anyone has questions on any other units or why they didn't change or anything like that, we can address that. The first, Box Elder Raft River, they're recommending an increase of 2 permits. The Cache, they're recommending an increase of 2. On the Chalk Creek Camas, again, 2 permit increase. Morgan South Ridge, 4. And I guess I should point out the strategy is on that far right side. So LE is limited entry, split is that, sort of hybrid, and then HO is harvest objective. So those would be quota units. And I can go back if anybody wants to look at those. So that's the northern region. Northeastern region, Book Cliffs East, they're not recommending any changes. They're at 29. Again, North Slope Three Corners, North Slope Summit, West Daggett, no changes. All harvest objective units. They are recommending a change on South Slope Vernal, Bonanza, Diamond of 2 permits. Actually, the quota increases by 2. Sometimes I use that interchangeably. Wasatch Mountains, Current Creek North, increasing by 2. Then we're into the central region. So an increase in, of two on Central Mountain's Nebo West face, and then Central Mountain's Southwest Manti increased by two. Oker Stansberry increase of one. Wasatch Mountain's extended archery, and I tried to come up with a name for this. We'll probably have to get a better one. This is a new opportunity. This is the portion of the Wasatch Mountains unit that's right east of Salt Lake City. And so Salt Lake County actually has some restrictions on things you can do in that area. And so what we're proposing is a harvest objective of six, but it's only going to be archery only is really the only option in there. And if you have specific questions about that, I'm sure you can, Riley can address those. But so that'd be an additional six on that unit. And then the West Desert Tintic Vernon, three additional permits. And then just to kind of throw up, this is the map of that Wasatch archery only area, just for reference. You can see Park City there on the right, and it's actually the southern end of the extended mule deer archery hunt boundary, but it ends at the northern region boundary of I-80. Southern region, Beaver recommending an increase of one on a split unit. Fillmore Pavant, an increase of three on a split unit. There are a couple of hunts like this Kaparowitz that are unlimited. There's a more detailed chart in your packet. You can see that's a remote unit. There aren't a lot of lions. They harvest very few, but they're trying to address concerns they have with the individual lions that figure out how to kill bighorn sheep. And so we don't, there aren't a lot of lions that get taken, but again, it is unlimited on those units. The Mount Dutton is an increase of one. We do have some, most of these increases are either due to the fact that they're within the management strategies and they can increase. There's opportunity on the table. In the case of Mount Dutton, this is one where they've had some issues with depredation and they want to address those and add another tag among with other strategies down there. Pine Valley North increased by two. Pine Valley South increased by one. They have a lot of units. Southwest Desert up by two and Zion up by two. There is one change here. The Plateau Thousand Lakes was a split unit, and they're changing that to a harvest objective unit. And it lengthens the season. It'll become a year-round unit. Still four, but it becomes a quota instead of a limited entry split kind of deal. So people can get in there. They're hoping they can get more harvest. They typically don't even fill the four tags every year. So, moving on to the southeastern region, the Central Mountains Southeast Manti increases by four. 9 Mile North by three. Again, they have those unlimited units. Same situation. They don't take a lot of lions. It's really remote country. Kind of to compile everything, I'm looking at limited entry, and I included in limited entry those split units versus harvest objective. You know, since 2015, we've kind of gone more over to the harvest objective side of things. These are the seasons proposed for next year. So limited entry would be November 8th through May 31st. The split would be limited entry from the 8th through February 25th, and then it would open as a harvest objective unit on those units from March 1st through May 31st. Harvest objective, November 8th through November 3rd of 18. So there's a little bit of a gap there, but it's pretty much year-round. Unlimited quotas, again, year-round. And then the pursuit season, November 8th through May 31st. And that's all I have.
Thanks, Darren. I'll go ahead and open it up for questions from the RAC. Anybody have a question for Darren on this? I've got Danny first, and then I'll catch you next.
So Darren, so one statistic that I keep failing to see, that I keep thinking just based on scientific literature and, you know, behavioral aspects of these puma, is the relationship between, because we do, all we can lean on is the harvest data. It's, you know, numbers right out in the field, not a chance, not really. So the ratio of younger males to older males, it seems like that's just a no-brainer statistic that should determine basically everything.
Right.
Any comment on that?
Yeah, so there are some things that I look at in the background that aren't in the management plan, but things that definitely want to be considered, and that's one thing we'll look at. You saw a glimpse of that in the average age of harvest. You can see that, you know, again, we harvest heavily on the male side. You could see that increase in the males, and so a lot of that is tied up in that statistic, and so we are seeing increasing average age of males in the harvest. So that's, you know, from a, if you're trying to maintain a cougar population, that's probably a good
right. But it's not like that's the end all to do all. I mean, quite frankly, people are losing pets, and there are all kinds of other social cougar-oriented issues that come into play here. And so, I think my point is a good one, though. What's the relative harvest of younger males to older males? That, you know, I think many of us believe that older males, you know, kind of help stabilize the behavioral aspects of that group.
That's some of the stuff coming out of Colorado and Washington is showing that. So I think what we've tried to do here is by adding that average age, you know, try to make sure that component is in our consideration in terms of a management strategy. So you know, the thinking there is that older age class males set up larger territories. They don't tend to overlap, so you could actually have fewer cougars on the landscape with older age classes than you might if you have a bunch of juveniles that have overlapping territories, that kind of thing. So,
well, and also one other consideration, you know, when you manage for, you know, a larger proportion of whether they're elk or cougar, then you're really managing for a trophy capacity in that sense. So,
what is your actual harvest? Do you have that? Did you achieve all of those?
Yeah, I can pull that up. I think it was 400. That first slide, it wasn't labeled, but let's go back to it real quick. And more slides in this presentation. Sorry about that. This is too fancy for me. I don't know how to run it, but we'll get there. Okay, so there's historic. So that green line is total harvest. You can see it's right on the 400 line. So it's been increasing.
Well, did that across each unit, were you pretty well on target? Or?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is a statewide perspective, and it varies by unit. Some units lend themselves to you know, opportunity, and access is probably the biggest thing. And others don't. So what happens is you get to a finer scale, you start seeing these source and sink kind of dynamics going, where people will go in and hit them hard in one area because, you know, it's easy to get to, and you've got an adjacent unit that's private land or rocky, rough terrain, and they'll actually feed into that. And so when you start delving into these metrics, you start seeing some variance in age classes and things like that. And the chart that was in your packet actually has, for each unit, what the percent females and age and over five for each unit on there. And we can, you know, if you have questions on that, obviously we can. One overall take home probably is, with only a few exceptions, all of these units are within the management parameters, even those that we're, you know, we're dealing with deer or bighorn sheep issues. So, you know, overall, things look pretty good from a cougar standpoint.
Any other questions?
Mike? Once again, I have a couple.
Sure.
Sorry.
No, great.
Like, just looking at the limited entry units, so we don't have a harvest objective there. We just give out that many tags,
right,
and that's how many people get to hunt. Do we have a success rates on those units?
Yeah, it runs, again, if you kind of mash everything together, it's about 75%.
Okay.
Statewide.
And the reason why I'm looking at the limited entry units is, in my mind, I can grasp how things are working there. So I served on the Cougar Management Committee that helped write the last plan. Like, if I looked at East Canyon, that's a limited entry unit.
Right.
The target is to have less than 40% of the take as females, and we're at half that, so we're at 18%. The target on the 5 years or older is 15 to 20% of the cats need to be five.
They're over it. Yeah,
and we're at 50%, and we only increased by 2 permits.
That's a private land unit.
But I know that if the tags were given, those ranchers and those CWMUs and those people up there would allow that access to
harvest. Yeah.
Well, some will and some won't. Right. But the point of it is and it extends when you look down at, like, a lot of the limited entry units, we're way under on our female targets, and we're way over on our 5 year or older targets, which should mean that there should be an increase in permits on those units.
Right.
And I'm not seeing an increase.
Lot of those. So, I mean, that specific unit is an access issue. They just can't. People just on that unit. They
do
don't
have the success rate on that unit.
Yeah. Let me look it up real quick. I'll pull the harvest up here, and we can look at it specifically.
You have that, Riley.
Yeah, East Canyon. East. Okay. Good. What's the harvest success on that? My recollection is that they don't fill the tags.
Percent permits.
Yeah.
Percent.
Oh, so they did fill them all.
Yeah.
How many tags?
Eight.
Isn't that one we increased on?
Well, you increased
by two,
but still. And that goes to my point that people can gain access on those properties, just like we do private land only elk tags.
Right.
You know, and they sold out this year fast.
Yeah,
I mean, people can gain the access. The animals are there to harvest.
Right.
So why aren't we issuing enough tags to harvest those?
A lot of these, you know, it the plan calls for an increase. The biologist makes a call as to, you know, and again, you know, I was in the northern region before this. East Canyon is tough. It's mostly CWMUs. They don't really allow a lot of.
Well, but you had 100% harvest, so they do allow.
Right.
So we can't say that they don't.
So
allow.
They are taking the animals.
Yes,
that,
and so and then it's the same if we look down like on Current Creek North.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 5% of the harvest is females, and our target is less than 40%.
Right.
So we're 8 times lower than we want to be, and we're at 47% on our 5 year old or over.
So that's,
we're over,
that's one where they could increase.
We're 150% over there,
right,
and we're giving out 2 extra tags.
Right. Yeah.
And so why aren't we giving out more tags to bring those into line with the management objectives that we have?
I don't know every single unit. I did ask them about that one. This one is one where the huntable ground is pretty much our WMA on Tabby Mountain, and they're worried about crowding. They're worried about putting a whole bunch of guys all on top of each other in a private or public land island surrounded by private land. So I think, though, your point's well taken. There probably is room on some of these units to increase further. These are the recommendations we're making.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Danny.
Yeah, so on the flip side of that comment, Mike, I do appreciate that. But it that might be at the expense of the social structure of some of these areas. If you look at that graph and you look at the blue and the males and the females going across, it's really hard not to notice that dramatic leap from 2015 to 17 in the harvest of males, and those are older, primarily older males. And so again, I just say that this is Darren's doing a balancing act between managing things as if they were deer and elk versus these kitties that have their own different social structure.
And I appreciate that aspect, Danny, but I spent 4 months of my life on that committee, I understand that we made targets, and there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that went into those targets.
Right.
And to see them, you know, I mean, there needs to be maybe more thought put into those onto how we can manage to the structure.
Right. And we did revisit some units, but again, you know, you expect to see increases on that unit. Whether that's, you know, enough of an increase, I guess, is open to discussion. But
are you still on questions?
Yeah, we're still on questions. So, all right, question. Anybody else from the RAC have a question? Come on up and state your name if you would.
My name is Chad Colburn. I have a question. You have two units that we didn't even fill last year, and we're adding permits to that. One's the Southeast Manti, and one is the Tinnick Vernon. So it's the opposite of yours, Mike. Now we're throwing permits to something. Can you respond to why we do that other than it's in the plan?
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that specifically other than to say that, you know, we saw some opportunity. But if you're not filling the tags, adding another tag maybe doesn't make any difference.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Questions right now?
I was just wondering if the lion unit is not considered for predator management, then why are we putting it on harvest objective?
We did actually make changes to the plan last year to allow for all the strategies to apply to all units. They still have to meet the criteria. It's just a strategy thing. So, you know, how you hunt them is really a social question. That's what this meeting's for, if you want to.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions from the public? Come on up. What was your name again, sir?
Sorry, Jason Walker.
Jason Walker.
I'm Brian Bittner, and actually I'm a wool grower, but also East Canyon, we have about 6,000 acres there, and I've never seen so many lions. And I totally agree with what he's saying, that I know a lot of the ranchers around there, we can get access. If somebody has a permit, we'll get you access. So I think that's a great objective. Also, I'm up in Strawberry with our sheep, and Strawberry's increased quite a bit. I had just today, in the middle of the day, when it was raining, we had two lambs killed by cougars. And obviously the bears are a problem too, but the cougars have increased a lot. And we've noticed with on our property, we've been there for 100 years, that I wish that we could increase the deer populations. I mean, that's my big thing. I love big bucks. And the cougars, the minute we have a lot of cougars, our deer go way down. And so, especially for what he's talking about, East Canyon and Summit right there, we can get you access. If you can get us some tags, we'll get it. I think that's a frustration for a lot of guys.
Okay. Thank you very much. Your name, if you would.
Seth Rockwell. My question is about the Vernon unit. So 3 years ago, it was limited entry. 2 years ago, you went to harvest objective, increased tag numbers. Last year, you increased tag numbers. You're increasing tag numbers this year, proposed, but the amount of lions you're killing up the unit has never raised. It averages, I think you just looked it up, 3 per year, and now we're going to jump to 8. It just doesn't make any sense to me to kill,
right,
to give out more tags to a unit where we never fill that unit ever. And the female, I think you said, was 33%, which is within your range of what you're looking for. But I hunt that unit religiously every year. That's my unit I love to hunt, and the lions just aren't there. Mm-hmm. We hunt that day in and day out, and you don't cut tracks out there like you used to even 10 years ago. but you're still giving more tag numbers for a unit that doesn't support that many lions. And I understand a lot of it is a desert terrain, but I mean, I go free cast dogs there, I hike there, I hunt there with snowmobiles, trucks for the whole season. I had the tag 3 years ago, and I treat two lions all season because I never could find a track.
Mm-hmm.
So to see you guys give more tags for a unit you're not filling is just...
Tags are opportunity, and so, you know, you may not take more lions, but another guy can go hunt the unit that, well, it's harvest objective, so any, you know.
It's just, split now, yeah. I don't understand the reason to split it over to harvest objective also, because you're not filling tags.
Yeah. So. I you know, specifically on the unit, I don't know if, Tom, you want to speak to that or not, but...
There's so few deer on the 10-ick that we have a hard time getting a sample size big enough to even get an idea what the population's doing. And it's way below objective. And the Vernon has always been a sensitive one for the deer population also. So we, I guess, decided to keep the pressure on the cougars as best we could to kind of give them a break. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't seem to equate, but...
Yeah.
We're gonna move on.
Well below objective, so that's where we
were at. We're gonna move on that, because I think the whole idea behind having cougar management plans and other plans is to try to follow a trend that's gonna go for anywhere from 5 to 10 years, and it's gonna have our ups and downs. And I do agree with, to a certain degree, that it's hard to harvest something that's not there, but I also agree that different people hunt different ways, and other opportunity might produce something different. You never know. With that in mind, we're going to open it up to a couple of comments that have not been called up here yet. Do we have any comments? I have a few comments out here, cards on the cougar recommendations. Dan?
Dan Cockane, president of Utah Houndsmen. Just to digress a little bit, but I want it on the record. After the further discussion with the Bobcat, we're totally in favor of opportunity, but we're not in favor of fiddling with those management plans. Like Mike said, there's a lot of time and effort and thought, and you know, 5 minutes in time here. So we would be opposed to fiddling with that management plan.
Thank you.
So we, we same thing with the cougars. There's a few tags here and there that could be argued, I suppose. But overall, we support the division's recommendation, and we feel that it fits within the management plan, and we think it's a good plan, and it deserves a chance to work and see what happens.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it, Dan. That's the only comment card I have on the Cougars still. Let's see, there's one right here.
Oh, you go last. Oh, it's the best place.
There you go.
My name's Chad Colburn. I sat on the committee with Cougar Management Plan. It's a good plan, as you can see looking right there. We got really aggressive after cougars through the 90s. No deer response. We had two good winters prior to this year. We got some coyote work. We got a pretty good response with deer. So from that, what we learned is, in that cougar management plan, there were so many diverse opinions of what we should do with cougars. Some people want them dead. all. Some people wanted them alive, all. But we put a plan together. And maybe that plan doesn't quite make sense of when we don't add permits or when we do add permits. But from that, I believe the plan should stand. And we're not smarter, I assure you, in this room than the people that sat in that Cougar management plan. I support the plan as presented. Let's follow the plan. We're here to manage cougars, increase deer populations. You know, it addressed all that through the whole plan. And when we tear that apart, like we just did in the Bobcat plan, saying we're smarter than the people that sat there, please, if you're intrigued next time, go sit in that four-month plan, and you'll see how humble you are. Because there are some people, Clint Meekum, Darren, way smarter than I was. You know, Dr. Wolf, please follow the plan. Stay on the plan. Cougars can be managed alongside with deer and elk, and it works.
Thank you.
And just for the record, Dr. Wolf, Clint Meekum, much smarter than I am.
Let's bring it back to the rack. Do we have any more comments on this?
Yeah, and I would echo those sentiments, and it's the reason why I didn't vote to approve the Bobcat amendment. I believe that we should stick to the plan. Having sat on a committee myself, I know the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into it. And so with that said, you know, Mike, from your perspective, I have a question for you. Do you feel like there are any of the proposals that are in, maybe that are in direct conflict with the plan?
Well, to me, and this is, and I'm just going to talk about limited entry units because I'm not going to get into the splits and the harvest objectives. I mean, you guys know all that. I think that any limited entry unit that is half, again, below what the female target is and is half again above what the age target is, we could add probably 40% of permits to that. And when I say 40, whoa, that sounds like a lot, but we're talking 10 permits, so we add 4 instead of adding 1 or 0.
That makes sense. But my question is there a mechanism specifically in the plan that says if you're achieving this number, you should raise or lower by this number? Are we in conflict anywhere is my question. I understand your point.
And I don't remember every trigger that we put in. In most plans, we don't tie the hands of the biologists with
right, so we have
that.
Some leeway so,
yeah,
to...
Exactly. Right. So we could do things, you know, to...
Right.
All the recommendations are within
the scope
parameters of the plan. It's more of a question of degree, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Increased 2, should we have increased 8?
Yeah.
That, you know...
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a limit on increase.
I think
20% is the yeah.
It's
thanks,
Cal.
That's right.
Try to.
Yeah, I seem to recall.
Take out the ups and the downs.
Yeah, take the big swings.
Mm-hmm.
And try to buffer that up.
Yeah, I seem to recall that as well.
Yeah,
so the two permits so would fit within that.
Yeah,
parameter.
So it would.
Mm-hmm. That explains a lot of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
That's where. That's probably why you're seeing ones and twos.
Yeah, and so the way to go through that plan, and probably can't do it here today, would be to, instead of having a limited entry unit in those units, you could have a harvest objective or a split unit, correct? Because you can do that on all three units now, because the plan was just amended.
It's up to the biologist's discretion, and it really does help. You know, if you've got a particular problem you're trying to address, it's nice to have that whole toolbox and not have your hands tied.
And just so you know, I don't hold any ill will about this, but I think it's good to talk about it, because if we don't talk about it, then it just passes through. And when we have units that are so, I mean, we see a population trend,
right,
and maybe that 20% cap can't keep up with that population trend to hold that that cougar population within the bounds that it needs
right
to be. So,
the lines that are on them limited entry units, that gives the guy an opportunity to
your chair, Tom, without five guys riding his butt at 3 a.m. in the morning trying to beat him in the same canyon. It's a lot better opportunity for a trophy hunter rather than some of these hard subject units. Some of these HO units are pure mayhem.
Yeah, I can understand what you're saying.
That's why.
All right. From the comment period here, any other comments from the RAC?
I'll make a proposal to accept the Cougar recommendations and rule amendments as proposed.
Do I have a second on that proposal?
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a second. Let's go ahead and do a vote on this real quick. This is on the Cougar recommendations and rural amendments for 2017 and 18 season. We have a recommendation to accept what the division has put forth today in its entirety. We have those who are for that. Could we have a vote on that? Okay. And those against? I have 8-4 and 1 against. Thank you.
All right.
Moving quickly along, we're moving to the Beaver Management Plan.
Almost through my stuff.
Be nice. Poor Darren. This is a tough one.
I know. I'm a glutton for punishment. And Mike, one thing, too, that these meetings help me with, you know, I'm still real green. These questions help a lot, so I don't take it personally. I want to hear your feedback, and if there's any weaknesses in what we're doing, I want to know so we can think about it for the future.
Well, and I think you're doing an excellent job presenting.
Yeah, right now. We'll see what you think after this.
Oh, no. I'm ready.
All right. All right, last but certainly not least, there we go. One of the... So when you get a new position with the division, usually what happens the first week is everybody that has a concern shows up in your office. And this is one of the things that came up. We wrote a beaver management plan in 2010. I think we're probably the only Western, I could be wrong, but I think we're the only Western state that actually has a formal plan to manage beavers. The plan calls for review every 5 years. Obviously, we've gone a little bit past that. And a lot of things have happened in the world of beavers since that plan was written, and we've learned some things, too. And so I took the opportunity to go ahead and open that plan. We pulled people in from the habitat section, aquatic section, wildlife sections within the division. We didn't have an external committee, but we did talk with external people during the process. And so what we're recommending today are some changes to that plan that reflects things that have been going on and the process of that review. So first of all, some things that changed. We realized that there are a lot of things in that original plan that we've done. Objectives have been reached. We said we're going to do this, and we did it. One of those things was a model that assesses beaver habitat across the state. So we can do a couple things with the model. It gives us a window onto what kind of habitat's available, what may be occupied, and it also lets us look at areas where that may be suitable for beavers, but they've been extirpated for some reason or other. That plan, that model is called the Beaver Reintroduction Assessment Tool. We call it BRAT for short. That was developed at USU as a result of the first plan. Another thing is there's a lot of interest both in the state and throughout the West in using beavers to restore suitable riparian systems where they're not present. And we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a minute. Let me just explain BRAT a little bit so we're all on the same page. I talked about how it assesses stream habitat for dam building. So it looks at woody vegetation, it looks at depth of the channel and aspect, and tries to find a suitable area where beavers could build dams. That's kind of the thing that drives it. Again, it can be used to determine where you're likely to find beavers, so if you're going to go do some censusing, you know where to look. It also flags areas where human conflict is likely, and it's very conservative in that aspect. It'll kick stuff out on the first pass that, you know, if it's close to a road, if it's near agriculture, anything like that, those areas are flagged, and, you know, if we want to do a project there, it adds hurdles. We need to make sure we're working with the local landowner, the county, all of those people to make sure that it's going to fly. And if, you know, if there's a conflict, then we just won't consider that site. And then finally, if a transplant site, for example, we want to move beavers into area, if it scores well in the model, then that will allow us to consider that area for that project. So what Brad is a GIS model. I'm assuming if you don't know what GIS is, it stands for Geographic Information System. So what it is it's satellites looking at the Earth, and it's layers of data that kind of stack on top of each other. And it can be different things, but we use that data then to make management decisions, to organize our spatial data. GIS is what we use with collared animals, for example. We can track them across the landscape. That's a layer in GIS. That's what BRAT does. And so this is an example of some output from this. This is Spawn Creek. This is up on the Logan Ranger District. And it'll classify reaches of streams into different categories. And so the blue here is a category known as living with beaver high. That just, you know, these categories mean things, and we can get into that if you're interested. The ones that we're the most interested in are the living with beaver areas and the low-hanging fruit. It just means it's got everything there. If there aren't beavers there, they're likely to establish and do well in those areas. And then you can see unsuitable human conflict areas, those orange areas on the map. This is where you can see there's a road there, there's camping, there's issues. So we want to look at that. Now, if we lay on top of that, the human conflict layer that I talked about, you can see that a lot of that turns red. And so these are all areas where if we want to do a project, we need to make sure we check that box and make sure that there really isn't going to be a human conflict. Again, the model's really conservative. It'll throw that on there in some areas where maybe it doesn't need to be. But it helps our biologists to say, okay, there may be a problem here. I need to get on the ground. I need to look at it and start working with people if we're going to do this project. And we did that on purpose. We want to make sure we're not causing problems for people without working through the details. One thing that came up during the process, why do we want to move beavers around anyway? There are some advantages. We talked a little bit earlier about this, but what you can get with beavers in a system is it tends to raise the water table. If you've got a system with cut banks, it can actually silt up the water within the banks, raise the water level to a point where it actually reconnects with the floodplain. That's good for a healthy riparian system. It creates fish habitat, pools, and it tends to create those kind of benefits. It can create additional big game and livestock grazing, and I can add sage grouse to that as well. By creating these wet meadow habitats. And they're just kind of a more diverse type of habitat. And they can help with flood control. They slow the flow, I guess, is something that's been hanging around. But they do tend to, they don't walk up water, but they do slow the amount of water that comes down all at once. And so you can, for fish, that's good. It helps keep a lot of the turbidity out of the water in the spring. If we're going to move beavers, we have some very specific things that have to happen in the plan. One is that any beavers from waters that we know have AISs, aquatic invasive species, so things like, quagga mussels, that kind of thing, whirling disease, we will not transfer those beavers to other areas that are not contaminated. I guess the first sentence says, we can go dirty to dirty. So if they've got a problem in the water, you can take the beaver to one that already has those species in it. If they
don't have AIS concerns, they can be transplanted wherever. If we get beavers from waters that we don't know, we will test, but if we're not sure, they need to undergo a 72-hour quarantine in a facility. This is actually one in the southern region where they're holding those beavers for 72 hours. They clean them down. It gives them a chance to pass everything in their system, that kind of thing. So finally, just in a nutshell, this is what we're proposing. We want to use the beaver reintroduction assessment tool to evaluate habitat restoration suitability areas. We want to avoid potential conflict. There's really fairly clear language in there about how you put management plans together and how you have to address all stakeholders if you're going to move animals around. We could use one thing the original plan did is it split beavers throughout the state into subspecies, and there isn't really strong evidence to indicate that that's a real thing. North American beavers pretty much are North American beaver species throughout the North America. So we got rid of that restriction. That allows us a little bit more flexibility in where we get source animals if we're going to do a project. And again, it requires that quarantine to avoid moving diseases and undesirable aquatic invasive species around the state. And that's it for the beaver plan.
Thanks, Darren.
Yeah.
Any comments from the rec?
Questions.
That's what I meant.
Oh, okay.
I'm just late in the day.
So this only pertains to beaver that build dams?
No, but
because I looked through the plan and even not looking for focus. I mean, I couldn't find anything that related to, for instance, the problem that the problems that we're seeing on, for instance, the lower Jordan River and those bank beaver that are basically denuding the parkway of overstory, you know, so that now we have what? Higher water temperatures, more algal blooms. It's just problematic. And so we need to deal with those beaver too. What does the plan say, or did I just miss it? What does the plan say, and how do we deal with that?
The plan allows flexibility to deal with, you know, problems. And so, you know, there are other rules that address, you know, things like nuisance beaver or beaver that are doing damage to habitat. What this change does is allows the flexibility in the plan then to deal with and move, you know, if we want to live capture, move those beavers right somewhere else, it allows us to do that.
And of course, those beaver are not, you know, right, they're not really, we don't want to move them.
Right.
They're as far down in the system as we can find, and so we don't want to move them anywhere.
There's also, you know, again, rules address, you know, lethal take of animals that are causing nuisance. And the plan really does recognize that there are areas where we don't want beavers, and we'll deal with beavers in those situations.
So maybe a pellet gun at night.
Right.
You laugh, but I mean,
get a trapper in there, and we will authorize in the fur bearer plan, I believe, you can be authorized to take beavers that are causing problems by following the rule. And
right. So
we can authorize that, yeah.
Right. And so if Salt Lake doesn't have a, you know, a discharge of firearm right restriction, then a pellet gun might actually work.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I'm just trying to solve a problem. It's a dramatic problem for restoration projects and other, you know, parkway projects, you know, through Salt Lake City proper especially.
Yeah, and this is a collaborative effort that, you know, we, if our habitat folks or aquatic folks have problems or concerns or want to try to establish these reintroduction areas, then the idea is the plan allows everybody to kind of play in the together. And
unfortunately, that hasn't happened in Salt Lake City proper. And so has there been any talk about doing, you know, specific beaver management plans for the likes of, you know, Riverton or Salt Lake
there
City?
There actually are. There is a precedent for that. Joe Wheaton at USU has written plans for Hardware Ranch, for Logan City, and for Park City. And so the plan would allow us to do that. We'd want to sit down, obviously, with Salt Lake and write a plan. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Any more questions from the rec?
Darren, George. I have a question for you. In your slide, when you said, you know, reintroduction proposal would have to score well in the BRAT, going through that BRAT, that assessment tool, what do you mean by score well, like an 80-100?
So, well, those categories, what the plan says, it needs to fall within, a preference will be given to areas that fall within, like the low-hanging fruit category or the living with beaver category, and they're, you know,
more by categories in a general.
Right, yeah, it's not a
kick out
of. Yeah, maybe that was just a poor choice of words, but basically what it does is we used to have a list, and what we found is that, first of all, statute doesn't require a list for beavers, only for big game and sensitive species. So we didn't have to have that. And what we found over the years is that the list either winds up being so general, like, you know, Bear River Range, it will be on the list. You know, well, where? You know, then I use that example up there. There's specific. And so what this does is allows us to drill down, determine if an area is suitable, and then, you know, we need to do some out on ground work, assess it. It may already have beavers in the system. And again, it's a starting point. It's a way to identify areas, and then all the legwork has to happen with, you know, with the land management agencies, the county, the local landowners, stuff like that.
Okay, any other questions from the RAC? And any questions on this from the public? I have some comments that we'll jump to here real shortly. So if that's the case, Kent? Is Kent still here? That makes it easy. And I think Ron's gone as well, right? Yep. I think they felt they got their 2 cents. Any other comments that need to come up before us on the rack? Any comments further? We're going to deal with these damn beavers or not?
appreciate you bringing up the damn beavers there, Dan. I'd like to make a proposal that we approve the beaver management plan as presented.
I'll second.
Second by Ken Strong. We have a motion on the floor here to accept the beaver management plan as presented. Let's go ahead and take it to vote. Those for that, could I have a vote on that, please? And that is unanimous. It was seconded by Ken Strong.
Thank you. I appreciate your questions and your time. I know I took a lot of it tonight. So.
Well, we appreciate you having enough breath to be able to do it all.
Good
so,
luck in the rest of the racks.
Yeah.
We're just warming you up.
Is it Dustin? Is that right? Yeah. Give me a minute. I'm going to have him do his presentation first, and I'll catch you right at the end. Go ahead. Right up, we have now, we actually have a original presentation, which is for informational purposes only, so we will not be voting on this tonight. And that is from Justin Hart, from Southeastern Regional Aquatics Manager, and he's going to talk about Schofield Reservoir Management Plan. If those of you who are on the rack a little earlier remember, somebody came up and had some pretty good concern about Schofield at one of our meetings not too long ago. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
I'm going to go through the management plan that was created through a public involvement process. It's really similar to plans that were developed for Jordanelle here, Fish Lake, Lake Powell. And I'll briefly describe how that process works. But to begin, let's give really, really briefly, let's talk about Schofield Reservoir and its history. Schofield Reservoir was originally built in 1926. And for the next 20 years or so, that lake was about half the size it is now. And it suffered from winter kills, some algae blooms, some summer kills, poor water quality, kind of what we're facing today in periods of low water, and also with Utah chub. In 1946, the dam was enlarged to its current size. I think it's a little bit over 70,000 acre feet in size. And by 1958, they did a rote-known project to eliminate Utah chub from the reservoir. We weren't able to figure out a cost on that original rote-known treatment project. But about 20 years later, they did another rote-known treatment project, and it was pretty much to eradicate Utah chub from the reservoir. And it costed around $100,000, and that is not adjusted for inflation. That was actual cost in 1977. And again, in 1991, the reservoir was treated with rote-known at a cost of around $300,000. Again, Utah chubs were a problem. There was also some illegally introduced walleye at that time, and then some carp. So those are all kind of targets of the project. Today, we estimate if a rotenone treatment were to occur, it could cost upwards of $1 million, depending on how much water was currently in the reservoir. In each of these cases, they eliminated the Utah chub and you know, some trout that were left in the reservoir, and they went back in with rainbow trout. They tried kokanee. They tried Lahontan cutthroat over the years. But they pretty much went right back with rainbow trout without any management changes. They didn't do anything like they did at Panguitch or Strawberry, where they implemented a slot limit immediately after to try to head off the chub. So that's kind of what's been done in the past. Why that animation's in there. It's kind of a cool picture. Again, real briefly, let's look at the use in Schofield. The first real creel survey we have, which estimated use, was in 1986. Prior to that, we had the seasons on fishing, where it was closed up until, I don't remember what the date was, after ice off sometime. If you look at the total effort, that second column, and down in 1986, there's an estimated 350,000 angling hours on Schofield Reservoir, which is a considerable number per acre for a 2,000-acre reservoir. 1997-98, there was another survey conducted, 278,000 hours. 2004-2005, it was down to 115,000 hours. 2007 was kind of a truncated creel survey we did to answer some specific questions. We estimated 55,000 hours there, but if you were to extrapolate that out to the year, again, I think we're decreasing. And then by 2015, the fishing was pretty poor with the chubs out there, and it dropped dramatically. However, all those other years, except for 2015, the fishing was good out there. The rainbow trout fishing was great. But still, we're seeing a decline in use. So the decline in use we're seeing is not solely poor fishing. It's other social things. I don't think anybody's got the answer to why. It's kind of a pattern we see statewide as a generalization. I think a lot of it has to do with this, the diversity of opportunities we have now compared to then. I've been here 15 years. It's incredible the different types of opportunities we have just within an hour of Schofield Reservoir alone, let alone my entire region. So there was some decreases in use before we had the chub problem. And then the catch per hour there, we try to manage for 0.5 fish an hour. We consider that good. As you can see, you know, fishing has been decent over the years, but we're still seeing a decrease in use. However, that 30,000 hours in 2015 was concerning. You know, there was a lot of people voicing their opinion last year at the RAC meeting in the spring. There's a lot of stuff on the internet. It was clear people were very unhappy with Schofield Reservoir. So last October and November, we initiated an online survey. It had 21 different questions, you know, kind of getting a sense of people's current satisfaction, ideas moving forward, what they'd like to see, what they would not like to see. And it also identified some individuals that were willing to volunteer to be a member on our management committee. So we put together a team. We tried to make it as diverse as possible. We tried to represent all the multiple user groups, you know, the family harvest-oriented fishermen, the trophy guys, the fly anglers. And we put a team together. We met for the first time this January. By mid-March, early March, we had a product report that we put out for review. Initially, that was reviewed internally with our staff in the Division of Wildlife. And then it was sent to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Upper Colorado River Recovery Program. Schofield Reservoir is located, well, pretty much my entire region drains into the Colorado River. And we have concerns with threatened and endangered species and also state conservation species. So we work closely with that group. And then our neighbors, Colorado and Wyoming, since anything we do here has the potential to affect them. We got that, all those comments back, and unfortunately we were not able to make the May RAC, which we were really shooting for, which is why we're here in July. So here's our committee. We had representation from the Blue Ribbon Fisheries Council, our RAC, Southeastern RAC, Mike King from the Wildlife Board participated. Ken Strong joined us shortly after our first meeting. We had the local park manager, a Schofield area resident, and a cabin owner, and then a number of anglers. For pretty much for the last 40 years, the use at Schofield Reservoir has primarily been about 70% from Utah and Salt Lake County, 20% from Carbon and Emery County, and then a few percent from the rest of the state. So we tried to have anglers represent that ratio. What was our purpose? We wanted them to provide input to help us develop a management plan for Schofield Reservoir. We determined a mission statement. We set goals and objectives for the fishery. They helped us make recommendations to achieve those goals, and we tried to consider all interests and find common ground. I said, you know, this process has happened on other reservoirs. This is probably the most controversial one we've done. There were a lot of strong feelings and a lot of passion about the direction we were going to take. So our mission statement, to develop a sport fish management plan that will provide the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources with recommendations and direction to create a sustainable and high-quality fishery at Schofield Reservoir. And we created six goals. The first one was to reestablish a family fishery and maintain a harvestable component to the fishery. In recent years, we have changed our management to try to control the chubs, and we've kind of lost this. We stopped stocking rainbow trout a number of years ago simply because they were not surviving and returning, and we focused more on the predatory species, primarily cutthroat and tiger trout. So we wanted to get that back. We also wanted to maintain and enhance the trophy angling opportunities. With those management changes, we created some incredible fishing. Initially for tiger trout, we broke the state record out there numerous times over a period of several years. And now we have some really trophy cutthroat opportunities out there. And we didn't want to get rid of those. We wanted to maintain them and make them even better. It seemed clear people wanted more diversity out there. People wanted rainbow trout back, but they wanted other species. They wanted a diversity of opportunities. So we're going to do that by adding alternative fish species. And the crux of the plan, the Utah chub, we needed to reduce the numbers of chubs with a sustainable management model. We also wanted to increase angling and recreational use, particularly at our state parks, our partners there. And the last one, manage Schofield Reservoir for compatibility with native species management, because it does flow eventually down the Price River into the Green in Colorado, and we do need to consider our agreements with those recovery program people and our neighboring states on fish species we can and cannot stock and use in my region. So let's talk about that first goal, the family fishery. Initially, we'd like to reinstate the stocking of rainbow trout utilizing a larger fish. Typically, we don't stock really large catchable fish in really large bodies of water because it's expensive. However, we're going to do that here to try to bridge that gap, to try to put a fish in the water that is immediately available for harvest. So that's how we're going to do that. We're probably going to look at around a 12-inch fish. We can do that within our hatchery system pretty easily. After we reduce the chub biomass a little bit and get rid of some of that competition, we'll go back to stocking, I call it a traditional size fish. It's a sub-catchable, about a 7-inch fish. It's a fish that's stocked, expected to grow through the next year and then be harvestable a year later. We're also going to utilize triploid sterile walleye and wipers as part of that harvestable component. And what we mean there is we're not going to put any restrictive regulations on those species. We're just going to use statewide creel limits. We're not going to go restrictive. We think we can meet our goals without putting crazy size limits and reduce creel limits on those. Goal two, the trophy opportunities. We're going to continue to use the Bear Lake Bonneville cutthroat and tiger trout that we're currently using and that are performing fairly well. And we're going to add the sterile walleye and wipers. And I think with the prey source that's out there, we're going to create some pretty amazing fishing with those species as well. And then the tiger muskie. We use tiger muskie in Joes Valley Reservoir, a reservoir that has not a serious chub problem, but has them. And that picture in the bottom left is what we're producing there. So it'll just create a really unique, different opportunity that's become really, really popular at Joes Valley. We think it'll become popular at Schofield as well. Enhance the diversity of angling opportunities. Some of this is redundant, but like I mentioned, we're going to add sterile walleye and wipers, which have never been in there before, the tiger muskies, and then, of course, continue with the rainbow trout, the tiger, and the cutthroat trout. So we will add a whole bunch of new opportunities up there. Reduce the chub numbers. You know, the Bear Lake Bonneville cutthroat and the tiger trout we're currently using, they're working. We've shifted the size structure on chubs to huge fish, about 10 inches. and we rarely see little young of the year fish anymore because they get eaten so quickly. The problem is we have a very, very large population of large adult chubs that can live up to 30 years, and we need to whittle those down faster. So we need to get more mouths in the water. We're going to do that with the walleye, the wipers, and the tiger muskie potentially. And then there's a real serious monitoring component to this goal. We sample out there twice a year with gill nets, and we can get a pretty good handle on size, structure, and densities. And if we need to add a little effort to that, we will. Increase angling and recreational use. Like I mentioned, angling effort has been declining despite good fishing, but we feel like we can raise angling effort 50% over the next 5 years and increase state park visitation and use by 50% as well. The Blue Ribbon Fisheries Council removed Schofield from the Blue Ribbon list in light of our struggle with the chubs and our change in management. It was originally put on the Blue Ribbon list because it was a family fishery. Since we don't have that anymore, they temporarily removed it, and we would like to get that back on there as soon as we can. And then lastly, but certainly not leastly, we need to figure out how to not impact fisheries downstream, particularly with our threatened and endangered species. Even though all the fish we're proposing adding to the reservoir that are new are sterile, we still need to worry about them escaping, getting out, and causing problems downstream. So we're going to look at putting in some sort of fish screen below the dam to eliminate, well, not eliminate, but to reduce to the extent possible escapement. And it's probably going to be some sort of temporary screening initially. The structure on the bottom right is a couple $100,000 structure in Colorado. That functions very well, but super expensive. So at first, we're going to use some temporary structures to assess, are any of these fish escaping in the first place? How big a problem is it? And then figure out a long-term solution. And we're not going to stock walleye until we at least have these temporary structures in place. So we'll probably miss walleye for this year. We hope to get him in next year. Real quick, let's talk about rotenone. With Utah chubs, there's two ways to solve the problem. There's biological, like we're proposing, and then there's rotenone. We talked at great length at that first meeting about using rotenone, and it wasn't unanimous, but the majority of the group didn't want to go that direction. However, we're not abandoning that. Anytime we use federal dollars on federal land and cause a disturbance, either biologically or physically, we have to go through the NEPA process, and we have to do that for a rotenone treatment as well. So right now, a private consulting firm is helping us write an environmental assessment for a rotenone treatment on Schofield Reservoir, all its tributaries, and a big length of its tailwater. So we'll have that document in place in case we need it. Also, the cost of this treatment could be pretty sizable, so we've been talking for quite a while now, and we will continue to talk and try to figure out how to fund this if we need to put it in place in a few years. The plan kind of loosely has a lifespan of 5 years. If we don't meet some of these goals and objectives by then, we're going to go to this rotenone option. However, if some of these species we're proposing using, these new species, we need them to perform well. If they don't take and establish, we'll know that before 5 years, so we could potentially go to this option before 5 years. I hope we don't need to, but if we do, we're going to have all the planning in place, hopefully the funding available to make it happen as quick as we can. And that is pretty much the plan in a nutshell.
Thanks, Justin. Quite enlightening. I think it's long overdue on that particular reservoir. I can remember experiencing that reservoir quite often with my grandfather when I was a youngster. So, and the fishing was really good. It is extremely good as the ice was coming off and you drop a bait over the edge. So, so it brings back great memories for me personally. So, do we have any questions on the rack concerning this?
Justin? Are we still looking at super catchables for Schofield, or are they off the table?
The super catchable idea was a 15-inch fish that we were trying to get from New Mexico in some sort of elaborate trade that I don't fully understand. So it's not off the table, but it's not something we can count on because it's kind of out of our hands. We're looking at trying to get those potentially next year, as long as New Mexico has them and we can work out an agreement, but we're not counting on them. It'd be nice to get them. We do have big fish program within our own system. They're not quite going to be 15 inches, but we can get them a little better than 12, I think, which is it's a reasonable size fish. The average fish at Schofield Reservoir over the years, give or take, was 13, 14 inches. So not quite 13, but close.
Sorry, super catchables. Could you elaborate?
It's just what New Mexico is growing, these really big rainbows.
Oh, so it's just the size of a fish. It's instantly catchable, basically.
Yeah, they're 15 inches, give or take. We call a catchable size fish.
Gotcha.
10, 12 inches.
Sorry, I was just curious.
These are bigger.
Gotcha.
It's a trophy.
Trophy stock.
Yeah.
Got it.
Broad shoulders. Any other questions?
I just got.
Go ahead.
No, I was just curious, Justin. What's the chances of getting rid of the chubs in there?
We had a really lengthy master's project done by Utah State, and it indicated the management strategy we're using could eventually do it. And based on our data, we're seeing exactly what we hope and expect to see with our current management plan. But like I mentioned, we're to a point now where we've shifted that size structure of the chubs to huge, 10, 12 inches. There's a few fish out there that can eat them, but not a lot. So basically, you have to wait for them to die, and they can live a very long time. And anything can happen in that time frame. It could reset. We could lose our predators. We had a horrible algae bloom last year. Luckily, we didn't lose a lot of trout, but we could. So with these additional predators, they'll be able to eat those larger size classes of fish and get that done more quickly.
So when the chub population is gone, then what do those predators shift to?
Well, our goal, I don't have a lot of numbers in this. There's a lot of numbers in the plan, a lot of measurables. I didn't want to go into that detail on every single one of our strategies tonight. But we don't want to eradicate them completely.
Okay.
We want to suppress them, down a lot. But they're always going to be there. They kind of always have been. But, at Joe's Valley Reservoir, for example, I mentioned with the tiger muskie, we've achieved a little bit of a balance. We're still growing some good trout. And some good tiger muskies. We've reduced our chub population somewhat. So it's kind of a balancing act. We don't want to annihilate them because then, like you said, the walleye or the wipers or whatever won't have anything to eat but trout. We don't want that.
Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you. Any other questions, guys?
Yeah.
I have one more comment from Dustin Brinkerhoff.
Thank you, Ken.
Ken, you need to say something?
I just want to say thanks. This has been educational. Your social media presence was in town, so I was able to stop in. I'm not officially here from the Home Builders Association, but I am a member and on the committee there. So if there's any need, we have government affairs, we have service projects and things in the Home Builders Association. So just want to say thanks, and it's been educational, and appreciate all you guys do.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ken, did you have one more comment?
I just want to make a statement. I've been lucky enough to be involved quite a bit in fishing over the last few years. And the rules and regulations, and a lot of them are federal regulations, that these guys have to go through, for instance, with the Colorado drainage in the Green River, they kind of have to jump through hoops sometimes to make things happen. And even though Justin and I haven't agreed on things over this plan, I think we got an agreement as to what has to be done, and I think that they're really heading in the right direction.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Well, I appreciate everybody coming. I don't think we have anything else before the rack. Besides, everybody drive home safe. I think we're supposed to get some rain tonight still, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so.
Which is much needed. Yeah. Thanks again. Appreciate everybody coming.